Welcome, everyone. This is Diana Oblinger, President and CEO of EDUCAUSE, and you're listening to EDUCAUSE Live. As you know, EDUCAUSE Live web seminars are supported by Dell, so if you'd like to learn more about Dell support for higher education, please go to dell.com/hi-ed. Now, you're probably familiar with the interface for our webcast, but let me just highlight a couple of things. First of all, we'd like for the session to be interactive, and on the left side of your screen, there's a chat box where you can submit questions for today's speaker and send messages to others, share resources. That's your area to talk, and we hope you will. You can also ask a technical question by directing a comment to technical help. Those of you who would like to join the back channel by tweeting, please use the hashtag EduLive. And the session will be recorded and the slides archived on the EDUCAUSE Live website, and you'll be able to pick those up later on today. And finally, if you experience any audio issues, would you click on the audio issues link? It's in the lower right-hand corner, and that will open up some FAQs and a new browser window, or you can send a message again to technical help, and we'll get you a call-in number and an access code. So now let me tell you a bit about today's webinar. In the old days, everybody left a big paper trail. And of course, today's students, scholars, administrators, just about all of us, leave a data exhaust when we use online tools. And of course, that data can provide detailed information about an individual's activities and identities, which enables personalization of service. But on the flip side, there are implications for online privacy in a world where we have such powerful tools that can analyze large data sets. Dr. Ed Felton will review with us the evolving public policy debate over online privacy, and then he's going to turn to focusing on the challenging issues facing higher education and help us exchange some ideas along the way. And the kinds of questions that I think will come out in today's discussion are, first of all, is privacy necessary for intellectual freedom? Should institutions be taking proactive steps to protect privacy as their constituents use interactive tools? And are there special challenges associated with all of this for online education? Let me tell you a little bit about Ed. Edward Felton is a professor of computer science and public affairs at Princeton University, and he's also the founding director of Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. In 2011 and 12, he served as the first chief technologist for the U.S. Federal Trade Commission. He's got quite a long publication record, something in excess of 80 papers and 2 books. He has researched on topics such as web security, copyright, copy protection, electronic voting, and covered his areas extensively in the popular press. You may have seen his weblog, which is at freedomtotinker.com, which is widely read for its commentary on areas like technology, law, and policy. With that publication record, you might guess that Ed has a number of additional accolades. He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's also a fellow of the ACM. He's testified before House and Senate committee hearings on privacy, electronic voting, and digital television. So, Ed, I'm absolutely delighted that you were able to join us, and I'd like to welcome you to EDUCAUSE Live as a part of our series on game changers and higher education in the connected age. Ed, over to you.
Thanks. So I'd like to talk today about privacy challenges that we all face in higher education. And this is informed by both what I've learned by participating in research and education related to privacy, as well as in the public policy sphere. And as Diana said, I served as the first chief technologist at the Federal Trade Commission in 2011 and 12. And the FTC is the primary federal agency responsible for law enforcement related to privacy, especially with regard to corporate practices. And I did a bunch of work on those issues from within government as well. So I'm going to give you today my perspective on what's happening in privacy and what it means for us in higher education. But first, I want to make clear that obviously we, because of the roles that our organizations play, have certain legal obligations with respect to privacy. And obviously, we're going to comply with our legal obligations. I'm not so much here to talk about that. I want to talk today about how to move beyond a discussion about compliance, taking compliance as given, and to ask questions really about what it is that we should do in dealing with privacy. That is, what are the things that we might be ethically obligated to do, even if not legally obligated, and what are the things that would just be a good idea for us to do in order to serve the interests of our institutions and our stakeholders. And I want to do this in two parts. I'm going to spend a fair amount of time at the beginning talking about the state of privacy, talking about what's going on in privacy, because I think we're at a really interesting point in the evolution of thinking about privacy in the technology world and in the policy world as well. I think we're at a kind of awkward transition, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And once I've kind of laid out what the state of play is and what it is that we know and don't know currently about what works and doesn't work and how to proceed in general, then I want to focus in the second part about issues that are specific to higher education. What are the issues, how do these issues play out specially for us in the business that we're in? So in talking about what the current state of privacy is, the analogy I often use is one to awkward adolescence. That is, we're in the state where we're not quite kids. We kind of have learned a bunch about the world, but we also haven't quite grown into adulthood to understand what's going on fully. And by the way, at this point, let me stop for a poll just for fun. And ask if you know which celebrity this is. This is an adolescent photo of a celebrity who you may have heard of. So go ahead and type your answers in, and let's see if anybody gets it right. All right, they're still coming in. So the first answer that came in was Brad Pitt. We had a bunch of others. Somebody said it was me. No pictures of me would be even more embarrassing than this. This is actually Ryan Seacrest at age 13. So having an awkward adolescent picture doesn't mean that you're going to be ugly or awkward as a grown-up. Nonetheless, I think this analogy of adolescence, that we're in the adolescence of privacy, is about right. And adolescence is all, of course, about learning how to deal with the world as it actually is. It's about learning how to deal with the complexities, the sort of simple models of the world that we had when we were younger may not be the whole story. For example, we might have learned when we were young, we might have made a rule that if a person in a mask carrying a knife offers to cut into us, that we should say no and run away. But of course, there are times when a person in a mask and a knife is exactly what we need. And understanding when that is and understanding how to tell that this offer to cut into you with a knife from a person in a mask is actually a good idea really is about building a better model of the world that deals with this kind of nuance. The other part of adolescence is making a transition to try to understand how to develop realistic expectations about the world. That although we may have wished for a career as a professional athlete, that is available to very few people, and a much better bet is to become a software developer. It's a story about moving from naive expectations to a more realistic model of the world. So online privacy, I would argue, is in its kind of awkward adolescence. And I want to talk about a few of the adolescent transitions that are going on in online privacy to give you an example of some of the issues that are emerging. And hopefully it'll be clear as I go through this section why this might touch us in higher education, although later on I'll dig into it a little bit more specifically. Okay, so the first trend I want to talk about is the breakdown of the concept of PII, personally identifiable information. Traditionally in the privacy world, the model has been that we divide all of the information that we have about people into PII, that's information which, like name, address, phone number, social security number, and so on, and that information is treated as sensitive, versus non-PII, all the other information, which we treat as relatively non-sensitive. And this is something that's that underlies a lot of current laws and regulations and a lot of current practices related to privacy. So let me stop now and ask, how important a role does the concept of PII play in your institution's policies? Okay, it looks like the poll has stabilized, and we have about 80% very important and about 20% somewhat important, and nobody below that. And that's pretty typical. PII, although I'll talk in a minute about why it might be problematic as a model, in some respects, it's what's come down to us historically, and in some respects, it is a model that we know how to deal with. And some of the newer models that are emerging to replace it are not quite fully baked yet. Nonetheless, let's talk a little bit about PII and why it has become increasingly problematic. So this is something that's been recognized for increasingly in the recent years. This slide is the cover of a 100-page-plus report on consumer privacy that was put out by the Federal Trade Commission in February of 2012 while I was working there. And this represented, to me, a sort of view of the conventional wisdom within the well-informed parts of government and the policy world about what's going on in privacy. And in this report, it said this about PII, based on comments that came in from the general public. It said, overall, the comments reflect a general acknowledgement that the traditional distinction between PII and non-PII has blurred, and that it's appropriate to more comprehensively examine data to determine the data's privacy implications. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why PII can be really problematic as a basis for making policy distinctions. And let's start with this. Here's some PII. This is my name tag from an event that that my center put on at Princeton, and I wore this around all day. And in fact, I forgot to take it off, and I wore it around town all evening. And to me, that's not a privacy problem. In most settings, I don't mind if people know my name. In some ways, that's one of the less interesting facts about me from a privacy standpoint. And yet, this is treated as PII. On the other hand, had I walked around town with this name tag saying this person is diabetic or this person or something about my religious beliefs or personal habits or something else about my family status, I would consider that more sensitive. And yet this label, diabetic, slapped onto somebody's chest like a name tag, is not PII, and a PII-based model would treat it as relatively benign. It's not personally identifiable information. And so this is a way in which, in some respects, the model of personally identifiable information as the truly sensitive information gets it exactly backward. Because my name tag, I don't mind, even though that is PII, but some of the most sensitive information, if revealed and attached to my person or to my online activities, would be much more sensitive. So in that respect, PII can get things backwards. Now, the other issue that I think has increasingly emerged with PII is the way in which it leads us to thinking in surprisingly inaccurate ways about privacy trade-offs. So here's an example of that. Here's a story from the beginning of a story from the New York Times in January of this year. And so if you look just at the first sentence of the story, it says, the genetic data posted online seemed perfectly anonymous, strings of billions of DNA letters from more than 1,000 people. And it goes on from there and to describe how researchers had managed to figure out how to take these online published genomes from these 1,000 people and figure out who the people were. And that, of course, led to a bunch of privacy concern. And so that's interesting in itself, although not super surprising to people who follow the work on privacy and re-identification in the research community. But what really struck me about this article is the assumption that's built into the very first line, that the complete genome of a person might seem perfectly anonymous. seems to me to be a pretty remarkable thing to say. Your genetic data is unique to you. It in some ways could not be more personal. It's unique to you. It reveals a lot of information that's relevant to your physical characteristics, to your health, to your personality and personal inclinations. All of that information is right there on the surface of your DNA. And of course, you leave a trail of DNA behind you wherever you go. And so in some ways, nothing could be less anonymous than DNA. It's as identifying as can get and almost as revelatory as any information that is available about you to a person who knows how to analyze it. And nonetheless, this model of thinking about privacy as being about names as opposed to characteristics of a person has led not only this writer but presumably the New York Times editors and a lot of the readers to go right past that first line, which should take us aback if we're thinking carefully. Okay. Now, there's been a ton of research in which researchers have worked to try to demonstrate, like the researchers did with the DNA in this example, the ability to re-identify information from seemingly innocuous data sets, or to make inferences about people from seemingly innocuous data sets. And this DNA example is one example. I want to talk about another example from my own research with my colleague Arvind Narayanan and several students, primarily Joe Calandrino. And we did a study that looked at collaborative recommendation systems. These are systems like, here's our paper. These are systems like the Amazon system that says people who bought this also bought these other things. So if you go to Amazon, I went to Amazon yesterday and it said people who bought Cooking for Geeks, which by the way is an excellent book, also bought these other items. No surprise, The Science of Good Cooking, The Chemistry of Cooking, another book about cooking science, and et cetera. It's no surprise probably that people who bought Cooking for Geeks bought this other stuff. But if you scroll a little bit down the list of people who bought Cooking for Geeks also bought these other things, you see some interesting stuff. You see the Clash's London Calling album. You see this book called Introductory Calculus for Infants. That's not a typo. It's a children's book which is filled with calculus puns that only the parents would get. You see a certain kind of coffee maker and a book of short stories. So this is clearly telling us more about the people who buy Cooking for Geeks, about what kind of stuff they like and that they bought. And what our research asked was, could you take information from customers who bought this, also bought that, systems at Amazon and all kinds of other places on the net, and could you use it to make inferences about what particular people had bought? So if you imagine, for example, that there were a book called The Book Only Ed Would Buy, which was so beautifully targeted that I was the only person who would ever possibly buy it. Well, if you saw on the list for Cooking for Geeks, people who bought this also bought The Book Only Ed Would Buy, then you would know that I had bought Cooking for Geeks. Now, obviously, there is no Book Only Ed Would Buy, but nonetheless, I have my own quirky tastes, and a person who knows a little bit about what kinds of books I own and have bought might be able to make inferences about what else I had bought by looking at these collaborative recommendation systems. And ultimately, that was the kind of problem that we studied. Now, notice, and we found that a fair amount of success in being able to make inferences about who had bought what on some of these different systems. So this shows also something interesting. Here you have information which isn't even really about a single individual. Customers who bought this also bought that. That's aggregate information aggregated over large numbers of Amazon users, and yet analyzed in the right way can allow you to make inferences about individuals. Now, I should say at this point that Amazon has modified their system in light of our work. And so these kinds of attacks would be much more difficult today. Nonetheless, absent a defense, this sort of thing appears to be possible. Okay, now the different ways of dealing with the breakdown of PII and the ability to make inferences from seemingly well-scrubbed data, one way is to just ignore the problem. That's actually pretty popular. Another way, which I think is even more dangerous in the long run, is to treat this sort of re-identification or information leakage out of these databases that don't contain PII as a kind of unfortunate accident. It's just a thing that happened, like a tree falling on your car. There's really nothing you could have done to know that the tree was going to fall right there on that day, and it's just bad luck. And if that's the model that you have of what's going wrong, then you're not going to do anything. You're not going to actually try to defend yourself or figure out how your practices might change. And I don't think things are really that bad. I think, in fact, that when it comes from a purely technical standpoint, that the glass is maybe a quarter full right now in terms of understanding how to deal with these issues and getting fuller. And one of the things we're realizing is that the traditional model of thinking about this kind of data that says that there's a pure trade-off between the privacy of data and the utility of that data in terms of ability to do analysis, extract value, find trends, and so on, is not quite the whole story. The idea that there's just kind of the policy discussion about this is just a tug of war between a privacy community and a utility or corporate or industry community is too often does describe what happens in the policy debates about this, but it needn't be the case because, in fact, in practice, things are a little bit more interesting and complicated than that. In practice, we really have a two-dimensional situation where it's possible to improve privacy without reducing utility. It's possible to increase utility without reducing privacy if we know what we're doing. It's really more of a two-dimensional space. And we find ourselves, if we find ourselves here in the middle of the space, we very often end up getting in a fight, a tug of war between people who want to go up and to the left and people who want to go down and to the right. And I think that when we think about the design of these systems and the policy fights, we don't think often enough about how to move up and to the right, about how to make everybody happier and make us better off. Now, of course, you know, we would all like to live in the upper right-hand corner where data is kept with perfect utility and perfect privacy, but we can't go there. There are inherent trade-offs, and there's kind of an area of this space that we can't go into, that we can't get to, that's unavailable in this universe simply because of the fundamental trade-offs related to statistics and the properties of information. But nonetheless, I think we gain from being able to think about this problem, being able to ask questions like, well, what's the shape of this red region? Are we actually on this frontier, or can we make things better by moving to the right or up and to the right? And once we get to that frontier, then we can have a tug of war about how to move along it. Now, I see that somebody asked about whether this is really just two-dimensional. And, of course, it is multidimensional. When it comes to utility, there's different dimensions of utility that you can get to. There are different dimensions of privacy that you can get to. And it's a complicated space. You can trade one thing off against another. But my frustration after working in the policy space for a while is that too often we fail even to get to the second dimension or even to think about whether it's possible to make everybody happier or to make somebody happier without making somebody less happy, that we can do a better job than we do at trading off privacy against data utility. Somebody asked whether risk would be a third dimension. Risk could be a dimension. When we're talking about privacy, really, you can view that as a kind of risk to the extent that there's uncertainty, technical uncertainty about what might be inferable by an adversary from a particular data set, you are often wise to think of it as a matter of risk. And so you can think of that privacy dimension as being a privacy risk dimension if you prefer. Okay, so there's a lesson here, I think, that emerges from all of this work on PII. And the lesson is that that making something non-PII does not imply that it's safe from a privacy standpoint, that any data might potentially cause you trouble. And therefore, you need to think in a more holistic and sophisticated way about what's actually in a data set and what can be learned from it. And the result of this in the statistics and computer science research community has been a kind of tearing down of old models of how we think about this, and now, fortunately, we're beginning to build up new models that can do a better job. That's a subject for another and more technical discussion, although I'm happy to address questions about that later. Okay. Here's another trend that we have seen, that digital privacy, that the trends and issues and problems that we see in the privacy world online seem to be moving offline. And this is driven essentially by the breaking down of a misconception that online and offline spheres are separate when it comes to privacy. And we see information flows in both directions between the online and the offline. Here's a story about Facebook using offline purchases that a person has made in order to target ads. In other words, here it says, the visual shows an opportunity that Facebook provides to let people, to let advertisers advertise to people who buy a lot of children's cereal. Children's cereal, I think, is code probably for cereal with a lot of sugar in it. And Facebook is getting this data about offline purchases, presumably from your grocery store, and then using it to target ads in the online space. And so things that you do offline find their way into the online space. Here's another one about the other direction, in which someone is doing marketing in offline marketing by mailers or newspaper ads or something like that, and they're trying to measure their return on investment in that marketing by using online tools. They're trying to see answer questions like when we advertise to a population, how many people from that population are going to come and look at our website, how many are going to buy things from us online, and so on. And so you see there the use of online information to optimize offline marketing behavior. The other element, the other angle that is going on with respect to online and offline merging is the role of mobile phones. Mobile phones and smartphones, of course, everybody has them. Certainly every student seems to have one. And these are devices which are at a really interesting intersection between the online and offline space. Of course, they are online almost all the time. People use them to do all kinds of online activities. But they're also devices that are situated in the real world, and the ability of the device to know where it is, as well as other kinds of sensors, the microphone, the barometer, the accelerometer, and so on, allows the device to know things about the physical world. And more we're seeing industrial entities, companies, figuring out how to bring these things together through things like location-based advertising, as well as physical sensing applications that do things like sense how you as an individual move through a physical retail environment by sensing the location of your phone, and doing that by sensing your phone's broadcasting of various beacon signals that it does as part of its normal functioning. This also brings together the online and the offline in an interesting way. Another example of offline and online coming together is drones. We're seeing more and more deployment of drones. Drones are now available to civilian entities. You can buy them on Amazon. Here's a drone you can buy for $300 with overnight shipping, and you can even pick what color it is going to be. We have one of these in our lab, and indeed it's pretty much an idiot-proof technology. You control it with your mobile phone. It flies around. It has a surprisingly good camera. These things we're going to see more and more. And actually, I think at this point we have a poll. Do you know or have you seen a photo drone on your campus or in your city or town?
And Ed, when you get the results of the poll, maybe we'll pause for a couple of questions about some of the issues that you've raised.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. We'll do that. Okay. Let's wait a minute. Okay. I think we have it in. We have 12.7% yes have seen, know of, or seen a photo drone in campus or city or town. 12% yes, 88% no. Here on the Princeton campus, the yeses are rallying. Here on the Princeton campus, we did have a drone fly around a couple weeks ago and photograph the campus for some sort of admissions-related film. And there was a whole discussion on campus about when it was going to happen and the implications and who needed to be notified and so on. A bunch of interesting questions. But what we're seeing is we're seeing law enforcement getting more getting more drones. They're very cheap and surprisingly effective technology. Right now, they're used mostly for photographic purposes, but we're going to see more electronic sensors, more radios, and so on drones. And they will be able to gather a lot of information about who's doing what and where, including in spaces where that would not normally be physically accessible to these sorts of sensors. Okay, so let's talk about, let me turn to some questions.
Yeah, and one of them goes back to what you were talking about earlier, and the question was, someone was curious about whether Amazon made changes as a result
yes,
of your work.
Yes, they did.
Okay.
They did make some, they have made some changes since our work. Basically, the things that, and let me talk just briefly about this. Basically, the things that frustrate the kind of analysis that we were doing have to do with updating the information less often, so that more, so that longer periods of time are aggregated together. Other methods include things like adding random noise to the data, being especially careful to exclude information from sensitive kinds of purchases, and providing opt-out capabilities.
And one of the questions that I think several people are interested in, we've been having a little bit of a chat, is just thinking about Amazon and the recommendation systems. Those kinds of tools are beginning to work their way into higher education.
Yeah.
So we find there's one we're familiar with from Austin Peay State University that's called Degree Compass that helps recommend courses for students so that they stay on their degree programs, so that they're at the right level of difficulty.
Sure.
There are geo-tracking kinds of things, profiling, and a lot of things intended to improve student success. And I guess the question is, what are the pitfalls, and how should we be thinking of ourselves as different from the commercial sector?
Sure. Well, I mean, fundamentally, the reason the commercial sector wants a lot of this data is that it allows them to deliver something more effectively to their users. Sometimes it involves providing better service to their users. For example, Netflix has found that their business is a lot better when they can make accurate recommendations about what movies you're going to like based on what movies other people have liked. Or sometimes it's about delivering ads that are going to monetize better. You might or might not want that as a consumer, but certainly it's something that the publisher wants. And so in a sense, you know, what we're doing in higher education is similar. We're trying to provide something more effectively, whether it's recommendations for courses or whatever it might be, by using data. And this is all part of the big data trend that we're seeing everywhere. And to me, the intersection between big data and privacy is one of the really big questions that all of us are going to deal with. In some ways, we in universities have an easier trade-off. The relationship that we have, not that the technical issues are easy, but the relationship that we have with our students, for example, is, I think, less fraught with conflict than most of the time, than the relationship that businesses sometimes have with their customers, or especially that advertisers have with readers. But we do need to be aware of these issues and to try to follow best practices in terms of what we reveal. So, and let me talk a little bit more about recommendation systems. What led to the privacy issues with the recommendation systems that we studied in our research was the fact that the recommendations were based on either actions or opinions of other users. So if you're recommending something to a user based on, or to a student based on what they need to, what they need to complete their degree, or which courses are feasible to take together because of scheduling and so on, that's not information about other students. And so doesn't really implicate the privacy interests of other students. But when you start using recommendations or actions or decisions of other students to make those recommendations to some other students, then you do have to think about the possibility that information about what one student did that's private may sort of leak into or influence in a detectable way what we say to other students. And then we need to think about that and whether it's the right trade-off to make. When it comes to these policy issues, sometimes you do face some hard trade-offs about how much risk is appropriate to take with respect to some privacy issue in order to achieve some benefit. And I think it's useful to separate the question of is there risk, how much risk there is, from the decision about whether we're willing to accept that risk. At least analytically, I think it's useful. And most of what I wanted to do so far in this discussion is to try to talk about what are the sources of risk, how big is the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that then tees up the question of should we take the risk, how afraid should we be? And that's a whole other discussion.
Well, and I should, there's another question pending about how we treat online privacy and paper private or transactions differently, but I think I should let you continue because I think you're going to talk about that here in just a moment.
Yes, I think so. All right, so let's move ahead. So offline and online privacy aren't really that separate. It really makes more sense, I think, to talk about information privacy as a single entity, whether it's offline or online, because the information does, in the end, often flow back and forth between those worlds and get merged. It gets merged if we use our jobs. Just one more example of online versus offline privacy. Here's a Princeton University ID. Apparently, they've let a squirrel enroll this year. And anyway, like many student IDs, this contains an RFID device, which can be used to do things like open doors and log accesses. And that system, of course, is an example of the online versus offline privacy meeting that we've had in higher education for a long time. We're recording who goes through which doors when. We're recording the movement habits of students. And, of course, students are carrying these devices, which in principle might be sniffable at a distance by someone who has the right electronics. Okay, so the lesson here is we can't really ignore offline information or imagine that it doesn't lead to the same kinds of issues. All right, the third thing I want to talk about in terms of a trend is the trend toward measuring privacy, toward actually getting in there and looking at what's happening. There's a misconception here that you can't measure privacy, but of course you can measure information flow, at least sometimes. Here's an example. This is a tool called Wireshark, which lets you listen to all of the network traffic between some device, like in this case I think it's a person's phone, and everything on the internet. And those who do network operations have surely used Wireshark. But the point of this slide is that there are now actually some pretty excellent polished tools that are available for free, used in research, but also usable to understand what's going on with certain systems. And tools like this are really useful to understand information flows that go on in real systems. And so if we're developing technologies ourselves, if we're distributing them to our stakeholders, we can look and see what's happening. And we can look and see what's going across our network in an appropriate way in order to understand perhaps the privacy implications of what our people are doing. What you see here is a lot of data flowing across a network from somebody's phone. This is an example of what's often called data exhaust, the idea that just in the course of doing the ordinary stuff you do in the day, not because you set out to say, I want to send some information to somebody, but just because you have these electronic devices, they're always chattering with other devices, that you're sort of setting off this, you're sort of leaving behind you all of this data that can be collected. And this leads to a phenomenon often called online tracking. And you can get specific technically about what this is, but the bottom line is it's essentially the practice of people collecting and trying to collate the data exhaust. Now, the key step in online tracking like this is figuring out how to link the activities of a person over time. You can imagine little particles of data exhaust that you give off all the time. If somebody wants to build a sort of profile of what you do online, what they want to do is find the little particles of data exhaust that you give off and then link them together over time. Say all these bits of data exhaust really are the same person or the same device. link them together, and then a sort of picture emerges, a mosaic emerges about who you are and what you do. They can build up an activity profile of a user. This is a very common activity. There are tools like this tool called Collusion. This is an add-on for your web browser that you can get. And it gives you a graphical summary of all of the information linkages that get made. Here, each node, each little circle on this graph is one site on the net that your browser has interacted with. And every link represents an ability to connect, an activity that you did on one of these sites to something that you did on another site. So in principle, wherever there's a link, the data sets could have been merged. And as you can see, pretty much everything is connected to everything else, and you see a large number of entities. And indeed, it's often the case that you might visit a popular website, like, say, HuffingtonPost.com, and you might expose information about what you did there to 100 or more different sites who are in a position to connect these things together. Okay. So now a poll. Have you ever used a tool like Collusion or something like this to visualize your data exhaust or how it gets used?
Do you think that many people will do it now that they know about it, Ed?
I don't know. I think Collusion is actually a pretty interesting and useful tool. You can, if you have a nice big monitor, you can put up the Collusion window sort of on one side and go about your daily browsing on the other side, and you can see all of these circles appearing and connecting themselves to each other. You can see the graph kind of filling itself in. It's a really interesting and sort of eye-opening way of seeing what's going on. Okay, so the poll is in. We have about 12.5% yes, about 87.5% no, so most people have not. These tools are not that well known, but they are sort of out there. Okay, so let's see, let's move on. Here's another example. Here's a study that came from a researcher at Stanford University, Jonathan Mayer. He's looking at all kinds of different privacy tools and seeing when you use these privacy tools and visit the 1,000 most popular sites on the net, what happens? How does it change the amount of data exhaust that gets picked up? And you can see that it's possible to measure these things, and there are substantial differences from one tool to another. Okay, enough said about that. Here's an interesting example from the Wall Street Journal. They built this online visualization tool that lets you, again, see all the different trackers and how they connect to each other. So there are quite a few interesting tools that help people visualize what's happening to their data exhaust. Okay, let's move on now. And we've gotten into this previously, and of course it's hard not to in discussing these issues. Well, let's talk about what should we do in higher education. And we could talk for days about this, but I want to talk about just a few things. But the first thing is to start by asking what makes us different. One of the things that makes us different is that our users are different. Our user population is different or has different interests than perhaps the users of a typical internet service provider or an information service like Google. For one thing, our users tend to be explorers and researchers. Both professionally and personally, they're trying out different things. Our people, when they read, tend to read a wider variety of things, including some things that are much edgier. And so maybe we have more concern about maybe we have more concern about tools that gather information about who reads what and collates it. We value intellectual freedom perhaps more than people in other settings do, our users do. And finally, for many of us, we have residential users, people for whom we're not just a workplace or a place of learning, but we are their primary home, and therefore we're their primary home, and therefore we function as their internet service provider. And these, of course, are our youngest, most impressionable users, and the ones who need the most help. So our user population is a little bit different. But let me actually throw this out to you. In what other ways are our users different? And this poll just asks for short answers. Okay, I see the poll not popping up. Here, there it is. Okay, good. Our users are younger. That's a good answer. Our users are younger and more sophisticated, which can actually be a dangerous combination. Naive, some are actually under 18. They're minors. That's a good example. drivers of innovation. They're certainly doing things that other people aren't doing. They have high expectations for service. They use technology a lot, don't always understand it. Sure, so lots of great examples here. They trust us more than they might trust a company, and hopefully we merit that. Okay, this is really helpful, thanks. Okay, so let's move on. One thing that's not different about our users is that they rely a lot on outside services not provided by us. Sometimes they rely on outside services because we have some sort of contractual arrangement with an outside provider, or because a faculty member in teaching or in research chooses to work with an outside provider. But even when that's not the case, our users are just used to using outside providers. They will forward their university email to Gmail or whatever it is. And so they rely a lot on outside services. Nonetheless, we're in a position where we would like to be able to help protect them. Okay, so what can we do to help protect them? Well, one thing we can do is try to protect them from this data exhaust problem. So we can try to reduce profile collection about our users. We can try to take proactive steps to do that. And the best way to do that probably is to try to reduce the linkage of activities over time, because it's those links that you saw in the collusion diagram, for example, that really allow the construction of a comprehensive profile of a person. So what can we do to reduce the linkage of our users' activities over time? Well, there are three things we might try to do. One of them is we can look at how we configure end-user systems. If we are pre-configuring systems for our users, if we are setting defaults, if we're selling systems to them pre-configured, or if we have a standard desktop setup, we might look at how we can put those systems into a more privacy-sensitive state, change some of the defaults, for example, to modes that will protect our users more. Another thing that we can do, number two, is to try to manage the visible identifiers that we create for our users. And this connects to, what we've traditionally been doing to try to get rid of unique identifiers, especially get rid of the use of a social security number in a lot of places. But we can think carefully about what kind of visible identifiers we create that might be used to link our people's activities together over time. For example, if we assign a static IP address to the computer of every student that stays constant for their 4 years with us, that's a visible identifier that outside entities will be able to pick up on and use to link activities together over time. To the extent that we can avoid doing that, we might provide better protection for our people as they use our systems. And then finally, number three, the business we're in, education. What can we do to help people understand what's going on in terms of training, in terms of configuration of systems, and in terms of what we do in the classroom and in the residential experience to try to help students especially understand the implications of what they're doing? Okay. Another issue I want to talk about is research data. In research, we often collect data about individuals. Now, obviously, we have responsibilities there related to human subjects in research and so on. As I said at the beginning, of course, we're going to comply with those. But given the difficulties in the PII, non-PII distinction, given the challenges of telling which data is going to be sensitive or might be sensitive, we need to consider the possibility that the rules that we have imposed or the rules that are that are applied to us related to data about individuals from research are not the whole story and don't necessarily, that the rules that exist may not exhaust our ethical obligations or best practices. So we need to think, I think, carefully about risk analysis in this space. It's complicated to figure out what might be inferable from a particular data set. But we need to be careful not to just assume that because something meets a standard for being not PII, for example, that we don't need to at least stop and think about what we're gathering and how we're handling it. And that's an issue that we could go into in much, much more detail. And finally, I want to turn to the thing that no academic audience can ever stop talking about once they start. That's why I put it at the end. And that is online education, in particular, particular MOOCs. There's all kinds of interesting aspects of online education and massive online courses. One of the biggest ones is that A lot of it is done through platforms that are developed by outside entities. And of course, when someone is using one of these courses, they're generating microdata on their learning activities, how often they looked at each thing, where they clicked, where their mouse moved, all kinds of aspects of their learning experience, which would not have been recorded or recordable before, suddenly become data. And that data can be incredibly valuable from a research standpoint, but it's also data exhaust that comes off of the very core of the learning activities that our students are doing. And therefore, we should be thinking pretty carefully about what it is that's being revealed to whom and under what conditions. So if you go to a place like Coursera and you look at their terms of use, it starts like this. This looks like a typical terms of use, giant scary caps. And it goes on and on and on for about 6,500 words, which is considerably longer than the U.S. Constitution. And so there are complicated things going on when we do online education, especially when we're using an outside platform. If we haven't done very carefully our due diligence with respect to the data exhaust that our students are generating, or if we are offering courses that are available to outside people, the data exhaust that those people are generating, then I think we have an obligation to do more. Again, that's a topic that we could talk about in a lot more detail, and I wanted to raise that. Finally, let me raise two more issues that relate to privacy. One has to do with law enforcement access. We're seeing periodically in the Washington policy process, we see policy flare-ups that relate to the question of law enforcement access to data versus privacy interests. We're seeing a couple of them going on right now over the Electronic Communication Privacy Act and over what seems to be an emerging FBI plan to require eavesdropping backdoors to be built into certain kinds of products. But law enforcement access, to the extent it's becoming easier, to the extent that there's more data that law enforcement wants, can also raise some interesting privacy issues to us, especially given our role. And then finally, something related to that is copyright owner access. There are obviously big institutional copyright owners who would like to know who's doing what in our systems, often for legitimate reasons. But unfortunately, there's now the growth of what are called copyright trolls. These are firms that essentially use the threat of copyright litigation against end users in order to try to extract money that they might not deserve. For example, threatening to file a very public lawsuit accusing someone of infringing the copyright on some pornographic movie with a really yucky-sounding name, not because they think they have a strong case, but just because they know people don't want to have the name of that movie associated with their name in public. Unfortunately, in some of these cases, the question of guilt or innocence becomes secondary. And so to the extent that our people might be subject to that, we again need to think really carefully, as we have been, I think, about the issues of copyright owner access to information about our users. Okay, so that's been kind of a whirlwind discussion of a lot of the issues I think we face related to privacy, the special issues we face. And let me now turn to the questions in the remaining time.
And Ed, I guess one of the questions that really jumps out at me is about the balance and how you reconcile these different perspectives. Early on, you brought up the example of DNA and how that is infinitely personal. We've talked about learning data, big data. Where and who is having this conversation? Because if you take MOOCs alone, there's a lot of discussion, or there are a lot of people getting interested in it, but I'm not sure these issues are coming out very quickly. So where should we turn, and how do we have those conversations? Any advice?
Well, this is tough because the conversations are difficult, and in a lot of cases we don't have all the facts that we'd like to have about that lets us characterize the risk that we face. And unfortunately, what's happened in a lot of the public policy processes generally is that people have responded to the uncertainty and the high stakes by not having the conversation or by finding ways of rationalizing or using euphemism to make the conversation go away. And that, I think, is And I think we need to try to avoid the temptation to do that. One thing we can do is, and one thing that I have started to try to do here, is to try to start a conversation about what the research community can do to help us, to help the people who have to make operational decisions. We're starting to see the emergence of new kinds of analytic techniques, new ways of handling data that provide stronger guarantees of privacy. I think we're at an exciting time. So this is one of the comparative advantages that we as educational institutions have, is the expertise that we have in-house at wrestling with some of the really hard technical challenges around what the risk is. Some of it is really about being cautious and trying to avoid a legalistic approach that says, for example, not PII, therefore we're good, don't worry about it. To recognize that any collection of information is going to involve some level of risk, and that we need to think, what happens if this leaks? What's the worst thing that someone could learn from this data set? So I think that's a useful process. A public discussion is, I think, hard to have, partly because, you know, there aren't silver bullet solutions, mm-hmm. and people worry that they are only bringing negative attention and litigation risk on themselves by acknowledging that they're worried about something.
Well, I think you've opened all of our eyes quite a bit on how to think about the information, Ed. It's absolutely fascinating. It's certainly critical for our community, and I hope we can have some further conversations about all this. So I want to thank you very much for your presentation, for the conversation. I want to thank all of you for joining us as well. And before you sign off, if you would click on the session evaluation link, which you'll find in the bottom corner of your screen, we would really appreciate getting your feedback on the session today as well as the overall series. And if you missed any part of today's conversation, if the audio stopped on you, remember we will archive this on the EDUCAUSE Live website, and it will have the slides and a complete replay of the session. If you would, please mark your calendar for the next EDUCAUSE Live session, which is scheduled for Tuesday, June 11th at 11 o'clock Eastern Time, and we will discuss the newly released Top 10 IT Issues in Higher Education. So again, let me thank you all for joining us. This is EDUCAUSE Live, a production of EDUCAUSE, the Higher Education Technology Association. This is Diana Oblinger. Thanks for joining us today.